Hey, everybody, and welcome to A Conversation With. Today's guest is David Hearn. David Hearn has got a book out called How Not to Make It in Hollywood, which I would think that would be a shorter book, but apparently not. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing great. And thank you so much, Bob, for having me on your show. Really looking forward to it. Thank you.
So, How Not to Make It in Hollywood, I mean...
It seems like an anti-book
a little bit, don't you think? Everybody wants to know how to make it, not how not to make it.
Exactly. And, you know, for every actor who has made it, there's 1,000 who haven't.
yeah.
And, you know, everybody always wants to know the stories of successful actors. How did Marilyn Monroe get started? Or what about Frank Sinatra or whatever? But I thought, you know, nobody's ever really written about the experience of actors that aren't celebs or big stars, but that work and struggle and, you know, make their way through the industry. I was in Hollywood proper for a decade, slamming away at it. And in my case, I was actually more successful after I left. It's kind of strange. Doesn't always work that way. But after I left Hollywood behind, I came up to the Bay Area where I currently live in Oakland, and I've worked more in stage, film, and TV than I did during my decade in Hollywood.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah. What would you attribute that to? So you think you had more connections outside of Hollywood?
Well, it kind of went like this. I really had difficulty getting an agent down there. I don't know why. I contacted almost everyone in existence. And I write about that in the book a lot. Just the grind of trying to get an agent. And it was just, I don't know. Agents look at you through a lens of money, kind of. You know, they need to see something they can make some money off of, basically.
Right.
Which I don't think about. I'm a writer and I'm an actor. I'm busy with that. That's why I need an agent. Anyway, when I came up here, the script kind of flipped, because then I was a guy up from Hollywood with some film credits, and I got representation almost immediately.
Oh, interesting. So you kind of played it the opposite way. So you went there, And then just because you were there, when you came back, they're like, oh, you were in Hollywood. We should do something.
Right. So it eventually worked to my advantage.
That's interesting. So why even bother? Why did you even bother? Why did you want to be an actor in the first place, really?
Well, in my
we'll get to the writer part. Let's talk about actor at the moment.
Okay. All right. Well, the actor thing, I think I had it since birth. It certainly feels that way. I was in my first stage production when I was 5 years old. And even then, when I was a little kid, I kind of took it seriously. And I remember thinking, it was a realization more than a decision. Oh, okay, this is what I do. This is the thing I'm supposed to be doing. And it was just kind of always like that. Writing came along a little later, and they both run on separate tracks. But that's the acting thing. The acting thing I was doing, I probably was doing it prenatally, and my mom didn't know.
You were holding your hand out and saying to be and not to be inside the womb.
That's right. To be or not to be. And then the doctor answered that question.
So were you a child actor then as well, I guess? You said it's like professionally or just in the local?
Well, in community, in local theater, and regional theater, whatever, any place I could work. As a kid, and then all through school, through junior high school and high school, and I was always in the play. It was second nature. So in my case, I kind of always knew, well, at some point, I'm going to have to go to Hollywood. That's where all the stuff supposedly happens.
That's and what I'm, they say. Although nowadays it doesn't seem to be the case, but pre-internet days, or actually even before or after internet days, what would you call this? Internet 2.0 days before pre-2.0? We have to give it some kind of a better name.
Hollywood is the factory, basically. When it comes to film and TV, that's where it gets made. So if you want to get in film and television, you kind of got to be there.
So when did you go? When did you go out there then? What age were you?
I was in my early 20s. I spent the 80s in Hollywood. So it was the pre-digital age. So everything was manual, including trying to get an agent.
Yeah.
Out there on the street, you know, mailing things through the snail mail to casting people and things like that. I hope that people read my book, because the enterprise of all the nitty gritty is what I deal with in the book, in an attempt to kind of maybe help other struggling actors to avoid some of the pitfalls I fell into. And I certainly blew a lot of money on stupid stuff. So I thought I can write a backwards memoir as a cautionary tale. Don't do the stuff I did. Here, I'll save you some legwork. But I also tried to make it entertaining. Above all else, I'm a comic writer guy, so the book is largely comedic.
Okay.
And I hope it's fun to read.
So when you went, your goal to be a character actor in Hollywood, or you have higher aspirations than that?
You nailed it right there. That's exactly what I wanted to do. That's kind of how I envisioned myself. Kind of a middle tier character guy, because they work a lot. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of where I'd like to be. You know, not a celeb or a star or any of that, but enough to kind of keep it going. But as I say in the book, you can't take your shot if they don't let you in the shooting gallery.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. And the very same people who can enable you to have a career can also prevent you from having one.
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah, that part of it is really draining, because I'm not trying to hustle a deal on the street. I'm an actor. I'm a writer. That's it. I need representation. I was never very good at the sort of the hustling aspect of it. That's why you need an agent in the first place, so they can handle that stuff. And in the meantime, you can do your craft, which turned around when I came up here. You know, I have representation here, and I've been real productive as a writer, too.
That's interesting. So in a way, even though your title, How Not to Make It in Hollywood, it may be how to leverage Hollywood to benefit you elsewhere.
Right. That's right. Or, yeah. Or how to learn never mind. I'm not going down that rabbit hole. How not to make it in Hollywood.
Oh, there you go. Did you have any success at all as far as, I mean,
could you talk
about what you were in the 80s? I'm familiar with the 80s.
Okay. Well, like I said, you know, I did better than some and worse than others. I did halvesies. Probably the biggest TV gig I had was on Freddy's Nightmares.
That
was syndicated Freddy Krueger, you know, TV version.
It was a Tales from the Crypt style thing that
late night
was capitalizing on that kind of genre.
Right, right.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So that was a syndicated piece. So then it wasn't necessarily a network thing, but that, so did you get representation to be in that? Did somebody do that, or is it just luck?
I had guys that said they would act on my behalf, and I think my paths crossed with a casting director at the time who knew about the role that was available. So I had somebody I could say was my agent.
Oh, okay.
Role came through a casting director. So it was just kind of a fluke of circumstance. But it was great.
It was like my Venmo agent for the day right there.
Yeah. It was a thrill. See, I'm an actor that I just love to work, period. I don't care where, when. I just love it. So, you know, it was, I think it was 3 days. 3 days in heaven, you know.
So then did you do a lot of auditions and so forth while you're out there?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that process. What's that like from the inside as far as that's concerned?
Well, now, keep in mind that live auditioning, after COVID, it kind of became a thing of the past.
Right, you send in a recording now, but...
Yeah, and it never fully kind of came back. There are some happening, I understand. Well, I'm kind of glad you brought it up because I loved auditioning. I was good at it. It was a skill I sort of polished. I loved walking into a room of strangers and just going for it. I looked forward to it. Whenever I had a couple on the calendar, I kind of felt a little bit employed.
Oh, the audition itself made you feel like at least I'm doing something.
It's a job. I got to get out there and do it. I kind of miss that aspect of it. Nowadays, you self-tape and you throw it in a Dropbox or something online and they review it that way. But there was kind of a thrilling, dangerous aspect to the live audition that I look forward to. It's fun. It's a challenge. It's a skill. You have to kind of get better at it.
So do you have one that stands out in your mind? You're like a story about an audition that either went well or went horribly?
Yes.
That you would like to relay to us?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. I write about this in the book as well. I was working as a bank teller in Century City in LA, you know, real drudge kind of job. And I got an audition for Hill Street Blues, which was the biggest show on TV at the time. And I said, oh God, you know, I only have a 1 hour lunch break. So it was one of these like, covert operations where I brought a change of clothes in the car and I brought a sack lunch and I did one of those things where I had to like make a dash for the car and change my clothes in the car and stuff a sandwich in my mouth while I jetted out to Studio City, got there, did the audition, blew it out the back door. I attribute it maybe to the how haphazard the audition itself was, because I just felt just on top of it. I just nailed it. And Stephen Boschko, the creator, was there at the time. And I remember thinking, oh yeah, I think I can nail this one. I felt so good that I went dancing out of the casting office. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a really, really good feeling to leave an audition feeling like you really gave it your 100%. Like there's nothing you could have done any better. That's just a fantastic feeling. In fact, as sort of a punchline to the story, no, I didn't get the role. But it taught me a lesson about casting, because the guy that they ended up casting in the role looked nothing like me at all. Mm-hmm. He was like a Hasidic looking older Jewish man, you know, like twice my age and about three times my weight. Okay. And I thought, okay, it was a character decision. That's what they have casting directors for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why a lot of times when I leave an audition behind, I sort of begin to put it out of my mind, because there's all kinds of factors at play that you may or may not know about. But I still remember that audition really fondly. Yeah. That's one that I continue to aspire to.
So even though you didn't get it, you were able to glean a piece of information out of there that helped you in the future. So then did that lead anywhere from that point or no?
You know, everything with me, it was just, I don't know, the fates were not with me at that particular time. I had so many almosts, you know. Almost, mm-hmm. This agent looks promising. Like maybe he's gonna take me on, or I'm up for this role. I am almost, you know, right. But not enough things landed. Like I said, like the Freddy Krueger show, you know, I did get that one. I did a bunch of industrial films. One small film movie role. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a smattering. It was enough to get a reel together of samples of my work. But you couldn't, you know, eventually down there, you need to get a foothold and things begin to build. And that's what I was able to do here in the Bay Area that I wasn't able to do down there. Mm-hmm. I still talk to people down there all the time. And if there's ever something up, you know, I'll probably bop down there and see what's up. Mm-hmm. But
it's not, yeah. It's not your home base or your goal at this point in time.
No.
Do you ever think that you would return?
I would return for work.
No, so, but I mean, like permanently, like I'm going to go back and.
No. I'm a cool weather guy. It's hot all the time down there. Yeah, I don't know. It was also a quality of life decision for me to kind of get out of there.
Is it because you said you were working as a bank teller and you're trying to do auditions where you don't at the time you wouldn't you had to make the time basically. You couldn't just record yourself and send it in. You had to make the time to be somewhere.
You had to. And not just that, but for all kinds of things. You know, I did things called showcases. They're these presentations of evenings of scenes for casting people. So I was always in rehearsal for something or writing something. Or, you know, there was always something I was fomenting over. Now here's another aspect to the Hollywood thing, which I think is important to mention. Here I am yakking about getting an agent or making it, or I know people who did, quotes, make it. Guys who got careers in gear and then they faded. I had one close friend who got this phenomenal gig on a soap opera that tapes in New York, you know, a major role in a major network soap opera. So he went out there to New York and I sort of lost touch with him for a while. And I heard he was just making money hand over fist. And I actually saw him on the show a couple of times. He started to appear on the cover of soap opera fan magazines and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then about a year and a half later, his character got written out of the show and he just sort of disappeared.
Yeah, so he was like a fake. He has to wait for his evil twin now.
You know, for maybe, for maybe about a year, and then it all just ended.
Yeah. Well, you know? I think that seems to be the cycle, right? And they always, you know, call it the the meat grinder or whatever, right? They always need fresh meat, and then they grind it up and send it out the other end.
Yeah.
That's kind of the Hollywood method.
Yeah, it happens. You know, you find, you know how people will go, hey, whatever happened to so-and-so? Remember that actor who was in this thing? Whatever happened to him? That's why I kind of aimed for the character actor vein, because that always sort of runs subterranean. Mm-hmm. You know, it's true. Leading men and women come and go. Character actors are always sort of more needed. They're the filler. Mm-hmm. They're the balance in the story. And there's always going to be supporting character roles. So,
okay.
There I am.
So you were there for a decade, and then you... Are you from San Francisco, or are you from...
I am from New York. That's New where York. I was
So you
born.
Went west, and then... But you liked it out west, and so you moved up to San Francisco. What drew you up to Northern California?
Actually, my family moved to Northern California directly from New York when I was still a kid. I was maybe 6.
So you were really young.
Yeah. Now, I've been back oodles of times. Yeah. I still consider New York to be my original home. Mm-hmm. But I did a lot of growing up in the Palo Alto area of California. And then I settled here in Oakland about 30 mm-hmm. years ago. And I'm a happy guy here.
So then you're obviously, you're still working. You're working on stuff and whatnot. So what's the landscape there as far as these things?
Oh, well, it sure is better than it was there. I got a movie, in fact, that I'm going to a screening of. Kind of nervous. I haven't seen it yet. Of a movie called Thirsty that I did here about a year and a half ago. It's just finishing up now. I'm probably going to find out at the screening what its official release date is. Mm-hmm. It's with Kyra Sedgwick and Thora Birch and a really terrific actress who's the lead. Her name is Jamie Newman. Mm-hmm.
So now you just put me closer to Kevin Bacon.
Right. Right. Okay,
with you as well. Yeah, you're one step closer to me. Right. If you remember that old thing about 6 degrees of Kevin right. Bacon. So you're like 1 degree off from Kevin Bacon at this point.
Be my guest.
That's interesting. Though. So Thirsty, though... The title could take it a lot of different directions. Could you give us a slight synopsis?
I think it may actually. I thought the script was pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a complex story about a woman, this lead woman, who's married and has, you know, newborn and young children at home. She works for the public defender's office. She's kind of politically oriented. And she decides to run for the mayor of Oakland. So I think it's sort of a fiction based on fact. I live in Oakland. And it's true that there were a number of women mayors of Oakland over the last couple of decades. And I think this is sort of a story based on that, but is a fictitious story.
An amalgam of sorts, huh?
Right. And it's mostly about how she kind of tries to maintain balance in her life of all this stuff, a job and a campaign and young kids and politics, the stuff that politics brings to her life.
Interesting. And your role is?
I am in the early part of the movie. I play her boss at the public defender's office.
Oh, okay.
So I'm the guy, you know, that she reports to initially in the movie. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I sure hope it comes across that way on film, because the guy was sort of a real person. You know, he's not a caricature or anything. He's sort of a regular, decent, workaday guy who is a little bit of a bureaucrat, you know, wants to do things by the book. wants to be a good boss, but sometimes isn't. And I thought, yeah, I could find something there to work with. And it made it a lot of fun. Plus the woman who's the writer director, her name's Emily Abt, ABT. And she was terrific to work with. It was really, I'm an actor that wants to be directed. I like to hear what a director wants and work toward that.
Interesting. So then have you any other projects of note that you'd say that in the Bay Area you're like, I'm really glad that I got to do this?
Oh yeah, yeah. There was a short-lived show called Trauma that filmed in San Francisco. It was an NBC action-packed show with explosions and stuff like that.
with a name like Trauma, you have to have explosions.
Right. People need to be traumatized.
Right. You got a lot of trauma going on. Yeah.
Well, I had always secretly desired to play a crazy guy. I always kind of thought, man, that would really, really be cool. Mm-hmm. I would love to play a complete raving maniac. And that's exactly what I got. I mean, it was like they just handed it to me. That's what you want. Here you go. The role was called Maniac. I mean, a guy who's like a nutcase running around with a baseball bat. So I just sailed through the audition. And oh my God, I loved it. It was so much fun.
So, because I don't recall that the show Trauma. What era are we talking about?
Oh, well, it's a modern day thing. You know, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's set in modern San Francisco. Gotcha. If you go on my IMDb page, mm-hmm. there are clips on there from all my stuff.
Gotcha.
People want to see me in action. And my gut says that Thirsty is going to be, I don't know about a hit because you can never predict, but I think it'll be well received because it's an intelligent movie.
Now, is it a streamer? Like nowadays, since everybody's doing production for their various platforms and whatever, is it going to be one of those, or is it going to be released for a while? Like Amazon has their own productions, and they put them in movies for a few weeks, and then they put them on Amazon.
Production arm going now.
Yeah.
I'm going to find out at the screening because
not positive.
The director is going to be there. They're going to let everybody know whatever the distribution deal is going to be. I'd be happy wherever. I don't care.
So they kind of just decided they were going to do this no matter what, and then they're working their way through the process.
Right, I think they're trying to get an independent distributor. I'm going to see it in a movie theater, so I think that's what they're aiming for, is to get it into theaters. But I don't know, it may go to Netflix or Hulu, who knows?
Yeah, always, you know, best laid plans.
Yeah.
But once you outlay the money, I suppose at some point you're like, hey, we got to get some of this money back.
Yeah.
And so whoever comes with some cash becomes your.
I did a movie a few years ago called Paradise Club that was shot here locally, mm-hmm. and it ended up on Amazon Video. Mm-hmm. You know, I was sort of sitting around waiting, and then just one night I'm clicking. Oh, there it is! It's an Amazon Video now.
That's interesting. So as an actor, then you're kind of left out of the loop, so to speak.
It depends upon what level, again, in the production you are. Mm-hmm. You know, the stars and the producer, director people usually get the biggest cut. If you're in the middle tier, like I thought that's where I was going to be, you know, operating, I had a number of coaches that could live comfortably off their residuals. Mm-hmm. In other words, if they've done enough film and television in the past that gets replayed or sold overseas or whatever it is, they you make some income off of that. Mm-hmm. So the more film money you amass, the more your residual income is.
Yeah. So you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. Basically, it becomes a gig, right? So you don't know what's going to happen to it after you're in it. You just get, okay, you do your bit. And mm-hmm. then obviously there's paperwork and whatnot. But right. you don't know if it's going to go to the theater, if it's, you know, going to go in the 80s, it went to video sometimes.
Yeah. Yes.
Or now to the streaming services, which, mm-hmm. you know, every generation loves to say we've got the best, right? But all the mm-hmm. streaming services is video. It's just right. now you don't have to have a cassette.
That's right. That's right.
So it's not really any better.
You know, there's just endless content. I love
right,
how
yeah.
they're always advertising more content. And I sort of joke, I go, no, please. That's too much content.
You get choice lock. So writing, let's talk a little bit about your writing. Right. So besides the book, right? So it sounds like you've been a writer for quite a while. Oh yeah, there's the book there.
Yes.
You've been a writer for quite some time. So have you always been writing as long as you've been acting?
Yes.
I mean, other than when you were a child, I mean, as an adult.
Well, as a child, I was writing childish stuff.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I was always kind of, as a kid, I liked to write skits and stuff and mm-hmm. perform them. And then, you know, through school, I started to write a little bit more attempts at real plays. So I have two screenplays that I feel pretty good about mm-hmm. and three pretty good stage plays. I also have some turkeys. ones that I gave up on. And this is my first book. Mm-hmm. Everything I've written prior to this was a screenplay or a stage play. Gotcha. This came out as a book because once I discovered what voice I was writing in, I realized, oh, this is a book. This isn't, you know, plays are dialogue and stage direction and stuff. Mm-hmm. Screenplays are scenes and shots. But this, I figured, is the first time I've written kind of in my own writer's voice.
Mm-hmm. So you're coming from your point of view for this one.
Right. This is my philosophy kind of art and of life. And also the other thing was, you know, I wish there had been a book like this when I first started out. I wish somebody would have pulled my coat a little bit. I could have used some guidance. I could have used a little bit of, hey, it kind of goes like this. Watch out for that. So I'm sort of trying to fill that role myself. I did all the mistakes, mm-hmm. and here's a better way to go about it. I got stuff that sounds like advice in there. I don't necessarily mean it that way. I'm trying to just report the facts as I observe them.
And so what, if you glean something from that, what would be one of those things that you'd be like, you know, not necessarily number one, but if you said, you know, here's something that you always want to remember.
Okay.
What would that be? Don't get a lease longer than 6 months. Or, I mean, you know.
Right. I probably would say, I mean, and I don't mean this negatively. Learn how to fail gracefully. Everybody fails at one point or another. Everybody makes a mistake or does the wrong thing or goes, oh boy, what was I thinking? Mm-hmm. So forgive yourself that, because you're going to do it a lot. Actors, they're very eager. Everybody wants to work and you want to please. But you're going to lose jobs and you're not going to get stuff. And there's going to be things that are disappointing. So you sort of, the sooner you learn to roll with that, the better your mental health overall will be.
So would you say you got because, I mean, obviously rejection is a huge part of this process. Whenever you first got there, did you get depressed because of
rejection? Well, you know, like not being able to get an agent all the time. I joke in the book, I go, is there a sign on my back that says do not represent? Is that what it is? You know, what's going on? Yeah, so there were plenty of time, but you know, it's really,
what did you do to bring yourself out of that? I mean, obviously at some point you reflect upon it and you're like, yeah, that's just the way it is. And you just have to, you know, kind of, you know, do things to help yourself. But while you're going through it, there's got to be some kind of epiphany or something, or not epiphany, but there's some kind of a situation where you're like, I'm, you know, this is terrible. How do I not feel terrible?
That's the end part of the book. That's the last part. You know, when I sort of added things up and said, you know, this equation is not panning out.
Mm-hmm. Now I can't imagine being a bank teller would be very cheerful. There's not really bank tellers that much anymore, but at the time, bank teller was it was a regular job, right?
I had tons of jobs. In fact, there's no way I could write the book without writing about jobs. So I have two entire chapters devoted to jobs.
give me the Forrest Gump, shrimp,
right?
Job list,
right? Bank teller, receptionist, file clerk, copy machine operator, fax supervisor, area manager, employee trainer, computer tape librarian. Is that enough?
Yeah, that's enough. but oddly, the funny thing, you say all those things, and there's a couple of them in there, to be honest. I mean, those would be a career for somebody.
Oh, yes. And they kept promoting me in spite of myself. You know, I was airing. Yeah. I mean, I had people, employees, people that I supervised. And I was a semi-important schmuck with business cards and a suit on and a briefcase.
But that wasn't what you wanted to do in your head, that you're like, this is okay, but I'd rather be doing
right.
This.
And the paradigm that I lived with for all those years, as I write in the book, all every day people in show business are telling me to get lost. And at the very same time, all the people I work with are saying, Dave, what are you doing here? How come you're not in show business?
So it's, you're stuck between, you know, worlds.
Right. So I go, I'm working on it. All right. Stay tuned.
Interesting. It just seems to me that, and your title there just kind of reflects that it has to be so aggravating, right? So you're going to auditions, you're seeing the people potentially who get the role, not let alone all the other people who were there to get the role.
Right.
And you probably aren't seeing them audition necessarily, but you're seeing them pre and post audition, right?
Yeah. And that's the old formula though.
Your experience, right?
The hallway together.
Yeah. But exactly. You had to be sitting there thinking, I mean, it's human nature, don't you think, to be like, look, you know, sizing up your competition.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. I'm sure they're all doing that.
and what was, if we had an inner monologue from David sizing up his Hill Street Blues competition, what would that be like?
With your permission, I'm going to read something.
You don't need permission. You do what you want.
At nearly every audition I went to, a scene played out in the waiting room that I witnessed 100 times. Two actors, usually male, would run into each other and launch into a twisted little ritual. Actor number one, hey, how you doing? Great to see you. What are you doing here? How did you get up on my part? actor number two. Hey, buddy, great to see you. Oh, God, not this guy. Actor number one. Hey, what have you been up to? Are you more successful than me? Actor number two. Oh, I just wrapped a movie with blank. Yes, I am. Actor number one. Oh, yeah, I worked with him last year on blank. I already know him better than you do, which means I'm further along in my career than you are. So your job isn't such a big deal. Great director, really nice guy. Really nice guy. Actor number two. Yeah, he is, isn't he? God, what an arrogant jerk. Note, this one's a giveaway. There aren't any really nice guys in Hollywood. Actor number one. Hey, do you remember blank? Et cetera, et cetera. Well, anyway.
Now, you've had to, during this, I mean, even back then, you had to run into these people who were still at it, right? You essentially gave yourself a decade, and at that point, you're like, you know what? I think greener pastures might be someplace else.
I just banging my head against the wall. I just said, it just feels too hard. I'm getting tired of trying to talk people into stuff. You know, it takes your focus away from what the energy for doing what you do. Mm-hmm. And there came a point where I was spending more energy on the external stuff than on the creative work. And that imbalance I couldn't live with. I needed to go someplace where I could live.
The hilarious thing is the way you describe it is that acting is really the hardest sales job you'll ever do.
Right. Without an agent.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you don't have somebody doing the sales and you're doing the sales, it's really the hardest sales job that you'll have because, you know, you're trying to convince them every time that I'm right for every different thing that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Which, you know.
And also you have to, tough. I have a whole chapter in the book on each aspect of the industry. I try to break it down as thoroughly as possible so that, you know, I cover almost every part of the business. Agents, unions, jobs, casting, cars, auditions, acting, writing, theater, coaching, more jobs. So that's an idea of, you know, how I have it broken down in the book.
So would you say, you know, reflecting on all this, right, looking back over this time and so forth, would you say you always, let me rephrase this. You always hear everybody say, just be yourself, right? On anything. It doesn't even matter what you're doing, acting or not. Mm-hmm. Just be yourself. Would you say that that piece of advice holds true for this as well?
Well, you know, it's funny when they say be yourself when you're not in character. Mm-hmm. You know, be your real self. Some guys are show business 24 hours a day. How you doing? Well,
at least from my, you know, layman's perception, a lot of the stars in these movies, right, don't really seem, I mean, their personas don't change from screen to interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems that that is their persona, only maybe slightly adjusted for a part. You know, right. I'm the president as opposed to just being this, you know, Hollywood right. star. But, you know, there's not a huge swing on a lot of these very, very, high-end celebrities. I mean, Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise in every movie right. Tom Cruise does. It's just to pick on him.
The difference between what I do, character acting, and leading man stuff. Mm-hmm. I feel kind of comfortable where I am. Leading men come and go. But, you know, character people will always be there. But yeah, some that's right. Some people are just who they are. Mm-hmm. In the movie.
Some of the character folks. I mean, if you watch, sometimes the same character folks play the same character, mm-hmm. but in a different right. movie. They're like, They're like basically, I'm trying to give you a good example off the top of my head here, but, you know, let's, well, there was a guy, now I'm blank on his name now, but there was a guy named, oh, his first name's Tracy. Anyway, back in the 80s, he was on a bunch of different shows. He was a very scruffy looking person, and I can't remember his last name.
Tracy Walter. Am I right? Are you talking about Tracy Walter?
I think you're right. And that was his persona. He was persona most of the time. He played the scruffy.
One of my best old friends was in a movie with him, Repo Man.
Repo, exactly. He was in Repo Man. So it must, his last name must be Walter. So, yeah, so he was in a bunch of stuff back in that time period. Actually, all the way in through the 90s. He was in the old, the Michael Keaton Batman as a kind of a thug type person. But anyway, yeah, but he always kind of was, he was a character actor, but he was always kind of the same, a variant of the same character.
Yeah, he had also kind of that chiseled character face.
Yeah, very sort of world-weary.
Yeah. You always saw him as sort of like the grimy guy in the diner who's serving the coffee or the, or like the repo guy in the movie. Yeah, always a real bent sort of character.
And the funny, I don't know why I remember this. He was in a show called Best of the West, and he was the scruffy character in Best of the West, which is a really old sitcom that no one remembers, more than likely. But anyhow, but it seems like that happens as well too. I know there are people. I mean, there are people obviously that can transform themselves into all these different things, but it, oddly enough, if you kind of look at it on a somewhat of a surface value, there's a lot of people that seem to get slotted into things. So a new example of that would be Giancarlo Esposito. He played Gus Fring in Breaking Bad.
Right.
He did a fantastic job of playing Gus Fring. And guess what? Right. He played Gus Fring in a show called The Gentlemen on Netflix because he was... you know what I mean? But I mean, it was not Gus Fring because it was a different character, but the character wasn't so different from Gus Fring because people identified with him so much in that character that, you know, obviously whenever he gets hired on, they're like, hey, can you do the Gus Fring thing, but now be Gus Fring with more money, or Gus Fring with who's not the, you know, the drug kingpin, but he is something else, you know. And I find that interesting.
I had a coach named Alan Garfield. He was a fairly well-known character actor in the 70s and 80s. He was in lots of stuff.
I recognize the name. I'm trying to think.
He played opposite everybody from Redford to Hoffman. I mean, he played. I'm trying to think of one of his more famous roles. Oh, he was in The Conversation with Gene Hackman.
Okay, who was he in The Conversation? Great movie, by the way.
Hackman's sort of bugging rival. He's sort of the portly sort of man.
Yeah.
You know, they're sort of in competition for who the best surveillance guy is.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Candidate with Robert Redford, he played Redford's press agent, the guy who does his television commercials.
Mm-hmm. I know who you're talking about now.
And he had a major role in Altman's Nashville. You know, he was really cooking with gas through the 70s and 80s. Well, I studied with him in his class. He did quite comfortably, even though he didn't work for a large chunk of time, because he got so much film in the early days that he could basically live off of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And then he taught. Then you were taking. So was it his class? Was it something that was of his own creation, or was he part of some conglomerate of class?
No, it was his own creation. In fact, he invited me. I ran into him in a office building. Hey, Alan Garfield. I just started talking with him. And he said, you want to come study with me? I've got a scene work class going on. Hey, absolutely. And within a few weeks, I was in his class working on a scene from a David Mamet play. And he was a terrific coach. I was really, I feel honored that I got to study with him.
The unfortunately, it brings in my head, Gene Hackman is another one of those movie stars that is Gene Hackman. I mean, he variants a little bit, but he's Gene Hackman.
Right. About the way that he worked,
yeah,
Gene Hackman, that really appealed to me. There's a familiarity that he puts through in movies like The Conversation or Scarecrow or even French Connection.
Yeah, seemed very, very comfortable and so forth. But as far as the variance in his character, it seemed to be more of a volume knob. He would get louder, he gets softer.
Right.
Now, if Gene Hackman, if I ever meet him, he'll be like, "You jerk." Anyway, I don't think that's going to happen. But anyhow, so it is interesting. So would you say there's a kind of tiers? So like you talked about Alan Garfield, right? So Alan Garfield was kind of going great guns. And you know, maybe they're like, okay, we've used Alan Garfield enough. And so then he's doing the acting things. So is there like a whole hierarchy of things that people do, like kind of on the way up and the way down, as it were?
Well, it is true that most people on their way up kind of did the stuff that I did. You do a little bit of industrial films, you do non-union stuff, because getting into the Screen Actors Guild is kind of one of those steps in the process. Mm-hmm. And then once you get in the Screen Actors Guild, you're not allowed to do non-union work anymore.
Well, unless you're sneaky, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I know some people that were sneaky about it, but anyhow.
Yeah, well.
unless, not supposed to.
Unless you're already wanted. If you're wanted for some role, mm-hmm. they'll do anything for you.
Right. It's so interesting. So if you had to give, as we're kind of wrapping up here, if you had to give three pieces of advice to anybody who is like, you know, they were in their hometown, you know, they kind of did the leads and all that kind of stuff,
right.
Or even the second lead or character parts or whatever. And they're like, I'm going to go out to Hollywood and, you know, try to make it. What would your top three pieces information they should take with them would be?
I would say don't get involved with any, you know, casting promise coming from anyone in which they want money up front. That's a fraud. Nobody does that. Even agents don't get paid until you do. They get a percentage of what you earn. No agent worth anything is going to ask you for some kind of fee up front. And if they do, you should probably report them to the Better Business Bureau.
There you go. You know, the funniest side for that piece of information is in podcasting now, people ask you for money to do interviews, you know, David.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't. Just to make it clear, I didn't ask for anything from you.
Yeah.
But there are places out there that do say, oh, can you have to pay a certain amount of money to be on this show, which is ridiculous. But that's
I write in the book about this whole thing that I went to, this whole shebang in a big hotel conference room called the Actors Group. And after a couple of hours of this nonsense, then at the end, they happen to mention the $500 fee that they're going to charge you, you know. So, yeah, be really wary of that. Tip number two, I would say, would be do not sweat not getting a role. It's as much a part of an actor's life as getting the role. That's what I meant about learning how to lose, because it's about 50-50. Some you get, some you don't. Some you really want bad and you don't get them. Some you could care less about, and then they just hand them to you. So just try to put it out of your mind. I mean, no actor can help wanting to work. We all want to work. But don't take it personally. If you don't get a role, it may have absolutely nothing to do whether you're any good or not. There are just too many factors involved in that part of the process. And I'm not sure what number three is, I didn't get married or have a family because of all my scramblings all around town. And that's something I think I sort of regret. Mm-hmm. You know, have a real life, have people in your world, have close friends and family. They matter a lot more than this nonsense out there. You know, I was by myself all the time. Plus, I was a young guy trying to make it. So I hung, you know, so much of my fate on this stuff. And that's not a good thing to do, because it's fickle. You know, You need to be prepared for whatever might
be called ficklewood, shouldn't it?
Ficklewood, yeah.
There's your next book, David. I just gave you a title.
Right. Right, take your lottery on the way in.
Well, David, thank you very much for talking to me today for giving everybody this great information. And I'm glad that, you know, there's so many tragic stories where people go and you know, try to shoot for these things. And then in the end, they're bitter and or they're addicted or or any number of things, you know, become victims of various situations. It sounds like you're doing fine and you're happy in your life and are doling out some good advice to people to be optimistically cautious as you approach these things in your life.
And Bob, you're the best blue cat
I've
ever spoken with.
I appreciate that. I'm shooting for that. I'm waiting for the category to come up somewhere. But if it comes up, I think I'm a shoo-in.
You got my vote.
Well, thanks, David. And everybody, check out David's book, How Not to Make It in Hollywood. I'm going to throw the Amazon thing up there again. So ACO/D. And I love that they don't, you know, put words in there. It's like all this gibberish. 32 ORSBG, which sounds like 32 measurements of some element on the periodic chart.
All right. Don't mind.
But thanks, everybody. Hold on just a second, David, and I'll be right back to you. But everybody else, we'll talk to you later.